from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. In a surprise announcement on Monday, Pope Benedict XVI said he would resign this month after less than 8 years in office. He's the first pope to resign in nearly 600 years when Pope Gregory XII stepped down, and the first to have done so voluntarily since Celestine V in 1294. Well, we'll get news from Rome, and we'll check in with Bay Area Catholics about who might be a successor and about the future of the Catholic Church in the United States and worldwide. Forum is next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. Citing failing health, 85-year-old Pope Benedict XVI resigned yesterday as head of the Holy See and leader of some 1.2 billion Catholics worldwide. The German-born former Cardinal Ratzinger became pope in April of 2005, and he will officially step down on the 28th of this month. This morning's opening Forum Hour, we discuss the resignation and succession of the Vatican's highest minister and the state of the Catholic Church. Joining us first is Sylvia Pagioli. She's with us this morning from Rome. She is senior European correspondent for NPR's Foreign Desk. And Sylvia Pagioli, good to have you back on Forum. Welcome.
Thank you. Nice to be back with you.
I guess the first question is, it seems to have taken everybody by surprise just about. Does that include the Vatican? Are many in the Vatican?
Well, I think so. We've had two briefings in a row yesterday and today with the Vatican spokesman. And from what we understand, perhaps only the dean of the cardinals, the College of Cardinals, Cardinal Angelo Sodano, may be one of the few who were tipped off, and probably some of very close aides to Pope Benedict, because translations of his statement were done very rapidly for all of us. But most people were very, very surprised. I've talked to a lot of Vatican analysts who are very close to the inside of the workings there, and they were all very, very surprised.
And we should mention that address was delivered in Latin. There is I'm reading some blogs, a suggestion that why would a pope or anybody else of that high esteem and position abrogate power? In other words, suggesting that maybe there's more to this story? That's been intimated by a number of people. You see any traces of that or fingerprints of that at all?
Oh, I'm sure there's a lot more to this story. Even today, we had another briefing, and I think there were more unanswered questions than those that were answered. If one looks back at Benedict himself, though, some signs were there already. In a book-length interview with a German journalist 2 years ago, he was asked specifically about possible resignation. It was at the height of the sex abuse scandal in Germany and in Ireland. And he said no to a specific question, would he think of resigning now? He said, absolutely not. You do not take a decision like that in a moment of difficulty. Such a decision can be taken only in a serene moment. And then on a very specific question, would he conceive of resigning? He made it clear very much. He said, yes, absolutely. If the time comes when a pope is aware that he no longer has the strength, physical and mental, to go ahead, it's not only a right to resign, it is in some cases even a duty. In addition, the most famous pope to have abdicated was Celestine V, not the last one, but one of the most important ones, and certainly he was done, it became very famous because Dante put him in one of the circles of hell. Well, he's buried in the town of Aquila in a church, and twice Benedict went to visit that church and to visit his tomb, and even left a stole of his on the tomb. So these are some signs that he was thinking about this for some time. Then more clearly, we were told today, the editorial director of the Vatican Daily, the Osservatore Romano, said that the decision to step down began maturing in his mind after a very grueling trip to Cuba and Mexico last year. And he held, very unusually, he held two consistories last year. Those are ceremonies to appoint new cardinals. It's very unusual. So it almost sounded like he was an old man in a hurry. None of these things really struck people at the time, but now people are putting some of these pieces together and see that this is something he's been thinking about for some time.
Well, we also heard from his brother that his doctor had advised no more transatlantic trips, and he certainly had a high visibility as a global pope.
Yes, certainly not as much as his predecessor, but indeed he had traveled quite a bit. But he always looked more uncomfortable than John Paul II in these travels. He didn't seem to enjoy the crowds as much, and this immovable papacy as much as John Paul. I think he was somebody who felt more at home in the Vatican. He was not as outward oriented as John Paul II.
Well, since you mentioned John Paul, now we've had two academic popes. Some are saying it's time for a diplomat, and a lot of people are saying it's time for a non-European pontiff. What's your sense of that with 47% of Catholics in Latin America, but the college overwhelmingly, not only European, the College of Cardinals, but conservative?
Well, indeed, I'd say the College of Cardinals is the mirror of the two popes, Benedict and his predecessor John Paul. And while I think it began to be much more internationalized by John Paul II, the Polish Pope, Benedict has returned a little bit more of emphasis towards Europe, and in particular to the Italians. They've gained a lot of influence in the College of Cardinals. There's an expression in Italian that says when a cardinal enters a conclave as a pope, he exits as a cardinal, meaning that it's very hard to figure out, from the front runners. But some names are being made, and there's an Italian, there's a Canadian, Mark Ouellette, who is a very important position in the Vatican.
He's the one who decides all the bishops, isn't he?
That's right. And the African, Cardinal Tuxin of Ghana, who runs the Justice and Peace Department in the Vatican. There's some Latin Americans. I think the possibilities of a Latin American are very good this time, and I think even Mark Ouellette has a very good chance. I'm not so sure that they're ready for an African.
And are they ready for much in the way of change? Given the fact that the last two popes have been certainly conservative, and there was an anti-secular doctrine that was very strongly associated with this pope, first pope to use TV and the first pope to go on Twitter, but nevertheless not moving anywhere in terms of homosexuality or reproductive rights or celibacy or female priests?
Absolutely, perhaps even being tougher on many of these issues than even John Paul II. I think there was an expression when we were waiting for the last conclave to see who could be the successor to John Paul II. Everybody talked about there's always been this theory of the pendulum, that you go from one conservative pope to a more liberal pope. Well, that was true until maybe John Paul II, but since then that's not been the case. I think given that there had been this very long papacy of John Paul and now nearly 8 years of Benedict, it's a packed court, if you will. And to see, a really big changes, I think, is difficult. The question this time, I think, is going to be very interesting, is contrary to the last conclave, there had been so much emotion over John Paul II, his long agony. He had been an incredibly charismatic pope, that a lot of sort of the controversy, the criticism of his papacy was a little bit overshadowed by all the emotion. I'm not so sure that's going to happen this time, and I'm curious to see if there's not going to be a lot more pressure from Catholic groups on the outside. I'm not sure it's going to be such a sort of beautiful, perfectly well choreographed conclave as the last one. I think there's going to be a lot of pressure. We have the case now, for instance, of controversy over Cardinal Mahoney. He's going to be among those electing the next pope. He is certainly in a big shadow over him in his diocese, his former diocese. So there's going to be, I think it's going to be a tough conclave, and I think the cardinals are going to be in a lot of outside pressure to choose a new path.
Sylvia Poggioli, appreciate so much your, as usual, astute observations. I thank you for being with us on Forum.
Thank you.
Silvia Pagioli is senior European correspondent for National Public Radio's Foreign Desk. Well, we've brought together some Bay Area Catholic leaders, and we're going to talk with them. And then, of course, we'll welcome your responses to this changing of the Vatican leadership. We have with us in studio Sally Vance Trembath, who is lecturer in religious studies at Santa Clara University. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you. Also glad to have George Weselek, who is director of the Department of Communications and Public Policy for the Archdiocese of California. He's with us this morning from Sonoma, and we welcome you.
Good to be here, Michael.
Good to have you, and also good to have Sister Mariana Farina, who is Associate Professor of Philosophy and Theology and Department Chair of Theology with the Dominican School of Philosophy and Theology at the GTU, the Graduate Theological Union. Sister Mariana Farina, welcome to Forum.
Thank you.
Sister, let me begin with you, if I may. The sense of just how the Pope is regarded now by most Catholics. And there's a good deal of high satisfaction among Catholics with nuns and priests and bishops, the leadership in general, according to at least Pew Research, despite all the concern about sexual abuse scandal and the rest, which we'll talk about. But there is, on the one hand, a kind of dominion and regal attitude that is traditional toward the Pope, and yet there's that kind of humble ministry that we associate with the Pope. I mean, on the one hand, maybe infallibility, and on the other hand, a human being. How do most Catholics see it, the Pope now, in your judgment?
Well, I think the important thing about our news yesterday was it really does point to the man, as you have referred to in the question that you raised. Really, what he's teaching us, you know, he's teaching us again this, showing us that what the papacy is all about. And I think that's an important point that is often missed in some of these news accounts. He's trying to tell us that, you know, the papacy is not a monarchy. The papacy is a ministry. And I think he's seen his papacy as ministry, not as, oh, now I have the power, now it's my turn. But really, it is something that I want to now, in my way, in what I feel being inspired by the Holy Spirit, to really help the church to see its role in the world. And the three encyclicals that he will be known for are really trying to promote the gospel values in the world. His first encyclical right out of the chute was Deus Caritas Est, God is love. And it's a wonderful encyclical that I use when I teach Catholic sexual ethics. Because it really talks about what is the vocation to love. And then he had Spes Salve, which was on the theological virtue of hope, certainly in looking at the global situation, the global crises around the world. This Pope reflects, meditates, and thinks deeply about hope and the need for hope in the world. And then more recently, his Caritas in Veritate, Love in Truth, where he's really challenging, and this was in the midst of the financial crisis. He talks about the importance of looking at economic reform, economic justice. He promotes a real compassionate understanding of people's needs. He takes.
I read that encyclical. It read like almost the rhetoric you read from progressives on the left.
Yes, it was amazing, and really it was a reflection on his two predecessors who have written on similar topics, and so a real kind of social justice in the marketplace, so to speak. So I think Catholics can look at that leadership, how he led as a minister, trying to once again proclaim the gospel values. I also think, even in his resignation too, I think with the new synod that met and the new directives about new evangelization, he really wants to speak to that need for us to make the gospel alive in people's lives around the world.
Well, certainly we're hearing from the Sister Sally Vance Trembath a very fine and positive portrayal of this Pope. Then there was more transparency given to the Roman Curia, for example, department heads who worked to oversee church governance, gerontocracy, but little or no real accountability. And he changed that. And he, for example, she mentioned sexual, his encyclical on sexuality, he allowed for use of condoms to prevent getting AIDS. But there were scandals in this Pope's tenure as well, charges of covering up sexual abuse, the butler with the private papers that corruption revealed, rehabilitation of a Holocaust denier, not to mention, what happened early on with Islam and that mentioned as a religion of violence, which caused a major stir. So we evaluate him as a man. I mean, from the perspective of all those positive things, along with, things that have plagued his tenure.
Yes, I'm with Sister Professor Perina, but if we put him in context, I had hoped for a pope in John Paul II and in Pope Benedict XVI, a pope who would usher in the great age of the bishop that would deal with the next movement in the Catholic Church, which is to bring the local community back into dialogue with the centralized authority of the Roman way of thinking. And neither of them did that. That's what Vatican II, Pope John the 23rd and Pope Paul the 6th, and then we often forget Pope John Paul I, who was only Pope for less than 40 days, but he seemed to be responding and saying, I'm not just going to tinker around the edges of changing the way that the institutional church functions. I'm really going to implement what Vatican II ushered in.
Haven't changed much since Vatican II. In reality, I mean, the fact is they used to call it when he was Cardinal Ratzinger, they called him God's Rottweiler. He was the tough theological disciplinarian, keeping everything pretty much status quo.
Right. With paying attention to that centralized authority, that if one of the roles of the institutional church is to protect identity, right, is to make sure that, a Catholic in Indonesia and a Catholic in Latin America and a Catholic in Davenport, Iowa, can relate to each other, see their Catholicism transparently, that makes sense to them. And that's the role. That was the role that Cardinal Ratzinger played. But that's not the role of the Pope, and certainly not the role of the Pope in the third millennium or after Vatican II. The role of the Pope changed. I mean, there was a paradigm shift in the Catholic Church, and we saw the first openings to that in many expressions of John the 23rd and Paul the 6th, and again, a little window with John Paul the 1st when he refused to be crowned. So that was a hopeful sign. And then there really was a pullback. My hope for Benedict the 16th was, because he is a brilliant man, that he would have invigorated the local church, given freedom back to the local church the way that it was in the first millennium. In the first millennium, the Pope did not function as a monarch or as a person who set the rules and regulations, and we have not seen that yet.
He's a brilliant man intellectually and theologically, but I remember him saying, I have no talent for organization or administration. let me go to George Weselek, who, again, is director of the Department of Communication and Public Policy with the Archdiocese of San Francisco. And George, I'm curious about the fact that when the Pope was Cardinal Ratzinger, he was replaced by our own Levada here, Cardinal Levada here from San Francisco. And is there a possibility of some kind of succession here? Or who's...
I'm laughing because I talked to him the other day, and I'm pretty sure he would laugh at that also. I think that's a long shot, if not an impossibility. He retired, of course, a couple of months ago from his role as the prefect for the Congregation of the Faith. He's now living somewhat happily in Menlo Park at seminary, St. Patrick's Seminary. He still has duties in Rome, of course. Having an American pope, even one more likely, which would be Cardinal Dolan from New York, I think is very, very much on the edges because of the fact that there's a great sensitivity, I think, in the rest of the 1.1 billion member church to the what they call the Imperium, the United States of America, which has this enormous power in the world, and to then see more power in their minds to an American pope would not be fitting.
Well, give us a sense of how the choice goes. The current dean of the College of Cardinals, Benedict, held that office before he became pope. Might that man be a likely choice for next pope? How is the dean actually chosen? Dean of the College of Cardinals,
The dean, I think it's a lot by age and kind of how long have you been there, and are you 80 yet? It's all of those kind of traditional criteria. And, of course, now the process is going to go into effect after February 28th, after the Pope resigns and the conclave will be called, and that sort of thing. So some of those ancient traditions will be put into effect. But I think I'm not a Vatican expert, and I'm certainly not a papal elector expert. But my understanding is that it's a this is new territory. You know, we have a living pope. There is not going to be the mourning period, the 9-day mourning period that there usually was. I think most important for this new conclave will be the meetings that they have before they go into the Sistine Chapel and are closed up there and take a vow of silence. I think the meetings that they have are meant to for them to get to know each other, for them to start talking about what are the needs of the church now. Those meetings, I think, are going to be extremely important before the conclave.
George, let me also ask you, because I know it's of great concern to many here in San Francisco, about the role of Cardinal Roger Mahoney and the fact that he will be involved in this conclave and involved in the voting. And for those who are not aware, Sylvia Poggioli mentioned this. He was rebuffed essentially for not doing enough to stop past sexual abuse and harm in his public duties in the Archdiocese, and actually used cemetery money to pay for sexual abuse settlements. To shield abusers from, and charged with shielding abusers from the police. I mean, these are serious kinds of things, and many are saying in the community here that this is a disgrace for him even to be voting.
Well, I think I can understand their concern, and I think you know, there is a shadow hanging over the Cardinal right now, and I have great respect for him, actually, because I work with him on other issues, especially the immigration issue, of which he's a tremendous champion and very passionate in terms of immigration reform. So I can understand their concern, but I think the only criteria that there would be for this conclave would be the criteria that has been there for years, and that is that you only have to be under 80 to be an elector. And in order to remove somebody from that, it would take an act of, I think, basically something very severe, like laicizing him, or the Pope would have to do something very definitive and impactful, which is not going to happen. So he is going to be in there voting.
George Weslick, again, is with us from Sonoma. He is director of the Department of Communications and Public Policy for the Archdiocese of San Francisco. And you can lend your voice here, or certainly join this conversation. What are your responses to the resignation of Pope, and what do you hope for succession, and what about this Pope's tenure in terms of evaluating it and assessing it, and the Mahoney case, since we brought it up, and the fact that he'll be voting? You may want to weigh in here with your sentiments or your thoughts, your questions and comments. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786, and feel free to call us now at that toll-free number, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite, 866-733-6786. And a number of other ways of communicating with us. You can email us if you prefer. That's forum@kqed.org, or simply go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment. Or go to our Facebook page or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is, and the Pope did some tweeting in his day, our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum. We spoke earlier with Sylvia Poggioli, senior European correspondent for NPR's Foreign Desk, with us for the hour. Sister Marianne Farina from Dominican School of Philosophy, George Weslick from the Archdiocese of San Francisco, and Sally Vance Trembeth from Santa Clara University. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. In a surprise announcement, just yesterday, Pope Benedict XVI said he would resign this month after less than 8 years in office, and he's the first pope to resign in nearly 600 years when Pope Gregory XII stepped down, and the first to have done so voluntarily since Celestine V back in 1294. We got news from Rome earlier with Silvia Poggioli, senior European correspondent for NPR's Foreign Desk, and are checking in with Bay Area Catholics, talking about who might be the successor as well as the future of the Catholic Church in the United States and worldwide. With us in studio is Sally Vance Trembath, who is a lecturer in religious studies at Santa Clara University. George Weselak, with us by phone from up in Sonoma, is director of the Department of Communications and Public Policy for the Archdiocese of San Francisco. And Sister Marianne Farina is associate professor of philosophy and theology and chair of the Department of Theology at Dominican School of Philosophy and Theology at the Graduate Theological Union. Just want to read a response from a listener named Beth, who says, I thought Pope Benedict XVI was a very poor choice, if for no other reason than his repugnant silence for years and years when the child sexual abuse issue was raised by concerned American Catholics to him directly, with not only proof of the evil deeds priests had done, but also proof of the financial payouts to victims to keep them quiet. I so hope and pray that the new pope will be younger, more aware of the real world, more compassionate, and more honest. And Barbie writes on our Facebook page, it would be nice to have a pope who actually reminds us of Jesus Christ. As far as I know, Jesus didn't have butlers dressing him, and his clothes weren't made with gold thread. I wonder, as a theologian, what your thoughts are when you hear that kind of remark, Sister Marianne Farina.
Well, indeed. I mean, I think that that's really behind also the depth of his decision to resign. I think he's seeing the need of this, you know, real globalized church, the church where we see is growing in Africa and in Asia, and how to address the needs that are there. You know, when you think about it, you know, the Pope periodically has what he calls these ad limina visits, where bishops from different dioceses around the world come and share with them their issues, their concerns. And all I can imagine at those meetings is that the list gets longer and longer and longer, and the issues are so much, you know, there's such great complexity around these issues. There are issues of how the church is dealing with society, how the church is dealing with helping to guide its members. And that the Pope realized that, yes, you know, I need somebody who is more energetic, somebody who could really address these global issues, needs to really take charge here. And the ministry is calling for that kind of energetic engagement with the issues around the world. And again, you know, one other thing, too, is I think that the Pope realized also in his own papacy that the important and difficult conversations that each of these episcopacies are involved in here in the United States and around the world, very complex issues. And so how to really have the energy to even bring groups of people together who could be experts around these issues, that takes a lot of energy to listen to those voices, to be able to respond. And I think his resignation is saying that, yes, that's where we have to go. You know, we're reminded, you know, 50 years ago was Vatican II, and one of the points that I always raise is that John the 23rd said that our church should be a church that is recognized as people who start the conversation, not stop the conversation. And I think that in order to do that, it takes a great deal of energy and gathering together people who could continue the conversation and engage in these difficult dialogues, as have been brought up by your listeners.
Yeah, and I want to go to our listeners and hear what they have to say, go to our phone callers. But first, I want to go back to you, Sally Vance Trembath. The church has been characterized now as being in a crisis of leadership. Is that a fair characterization?
Yes, it's the worst crisis of leadership since the Reformation. And it seems to me we talk a lot about Vatican II and we remember John the 23rd, but one of the things we don't do is we don't look at what's the single most important thing we needed to do after Vatican II. So as a theologian, when you ask theologians right after the council, what's going to happen? What's the single biggest thing? And
you know what the single biggest thing was with Vatican II that I remember?
What?
Your Catholic friend saying, now I can eat meat on Friday.
On Friday, right. Or we can hear the liturgy in English. But as far as the implementation of the really revolutionary ideas at Vatican II was to affirm the local church, was to have the local church actually listen and have power and not be just the functionaries of the centralized government in Rome, as the church was in the first millennium. And that has not happened. I had hoped, and I'm going to say this again, it should be be the great the age of the great bishop, and it hasn't been. That's what the church needs to do.
Well, George Leslick, your response to that, particularly in light of the fact that things don't seem to have moved much forward from Vatican II?
I think it depends on how you look at that and through which lens, whether it's moved forward or not. I think most people outside the church and many within the church think of it as this monolithic, very centralized kind of institution where if the Pope says something, it immediately goes down to the layman in the pew, and that's not true. I think we're a very decentralized group, and I see that every day in parishes, like in the archdiocese, where you go out there and people are living their lives, they're coming to church, they're staffing food pantries, they're visiting people in prison, they're visiting the sick, they're basically happy. They look at the Pope and the institutional church and even the bishop in their diocese more symbolically. It isn't through issues so much. And most of the church is not, we have in our diocese, for example, 41% Hispanics. We have 20% Filipinos. And most of these people are working, working people. They have jobs. Some of them have two and three jobs. Their issues are not the same issues as we might be discussing here, for example, which tend to be more upper level, if you will, or kind of more academic. Their issues are, I need work. I need housing. There's very poor housing. Our education is terrible for our kids. There's violence in the streets. Those are the kinds of issues that most of the people, the Catholics, and especially I'm talking about our archdiocese, but if you expand that to the globe, it is even more pronounced when you have many, millions and even a billion people, live on less than a dollar a day. So the issues are different, and I think people who view the church in a different way, and I think they view the Pope as more of a symbol of hope, a symbol of unity, a symbol of somebody who is talking about peace, somebody who is talking about alleviation of poverty. So, I think here we look at it through a different lens. We look at it through a secular lens that tends to emphasize, and I think overly, issues that are, not necessarily important to the rest of the world.
Well, here's another lens of that sort, perhaps. Laurie writes, as an American Catholic woman, I rejoice to hear that Pope Benedict resigned. Since his election, he has led the church in a more archaic direction, further and further leaving behind the church populace in America. He has diminished the role of women in the church and abandoned those abused in the church. The church is no longer inclusive, Catholic, and universal. Let's hope the conclave chooses wisely because the American church is leaning in another direction. Let me get some of your calls on here, and we begin, John, with you. Good morning.
Good morning to you. I was actually in Rome when Benedict was elected, and while I wasn't in St. Peter's Square, I was watching on television. And the minute that the cardinal said, Joseph Cardinale, my heart sank because I knew it was going to be Ratzinger. And while he has provided intellectual, theologically sound reflection on the philosophical principles of Catholicism, he has been, I think, a throwback in many ways to the Middle Ages, particularly even with his appointment of bishops. Look at the bishops who have been appointed on the West Coast. The Archbishop, the new Archbishop of Portland, Bishop Vasha up in Santa Rosa, and our own Archbishop in, these men talk about issues, to go to George's point, that are not the concerns of the people. Where are the bishops working with the poor? Where are they making statements and taking actions to help those who are disenfranchised and those who don't have a voice? They're more concerned about what many people are calling pelvic theological issues than they are about gospel values.
Thank you for that. And you say what, George Leslick, to that statement?
Well, I think I view that differently. I mean, I'm on the staff at the Archdiocese, and we we have a lot of people who are working very hard on issues in the community, immigration reform, poverty, alleviation of violence, etc. And our bishop, Archbishop Corleone, backs these 100% and issues statements about them and goes to visit these people in their need. So I think the work is going on, and I do agree that at times we get caught in this other sphere where we're talking about pelvic issues, as the caller mentioned. And I think, you know, it's a worthwhile discussion, and we need to do that because that's an important issue for a lot of people in the United States. But I don't think that's really where the life of the church is. I think the life of the church is really with the people, and it's a whole different set of issues.
All right. I want to go to more of our callers, and we go next to Colin. Good morning.
Good morning. The Irish Prime Minister had basically called out the papacy under Benedict as having downplayed the rape and torture of children, basically doing what they had done in the United States as well, covering up and transferring priests who'd abused children. My question is, Mr. Westlake, you mentioned that issues that concern only upper-income people. Are you saying that covering up the rape and torture of children is an issue that doesn't concern everyone?
Not at all. I think it does concern everyone, and I think it's a terrible shadow and scandal on the church. And we have a long way to go before we work our way out of that. And
George, excuse me. There's been a lot of response directed to the sexual abuse scandals, but I'm looking, for example, an email here from a woman named Patricia who says, records reveal the Vatican knew of these problems with pre-sex abuse long before Benedict. Why does Pope John Paul II get a pass?
Well, I think it's taken a while for the church to really understand what this sexual abuse has meant, and I think it's been an evolutionary kind of thing, and I think there's blame enough to go around, and I think the hierarchy deserves some of that blame, and I think that's going to work itself out as we go through.
Theologically, can you blame the Pope if the Pope has infallibility, or I don't want to get into a number of angels spinning on the head of a needle or anything like that here, but theologically, infallibility means infallibility, doesn't it?
Well, only in areas where he actually says, I intend this particular doctrine to be infallible. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't really pertain to what we're talking about.
But it does pertain to, say, embryonic stem cells or reproductive rights or homosexuality or premarital sex and so forth. Let me bring another caller in here, and that's Chris. Good morning.
Good morning.
Yes,
you know, I am a Catholic. I feel and have felt for a long time that there's just a vacuum of moral leadership that the Catholic Church could be providing, and it's not providing. And I think it's reflected in the fact that Cardinal Mahoney, who has recently been removed from his duties, has been shown to have shuffled priests around rather than dealing with the problem of priest abuse. Recently was just shown to have diverted $100 million from one fund to pay for settlements. He is going to be one of the cardinals who's actually electing the next pope, and that just shows that there's no accountability. When, I'm sorry, the gentleman who said that, you know, it's an evolving position for the hierarchy to understand how to deal with the sex abuse scandal. You know, as a parent, I find that really, really hard to accept. And as a parent of a young child who is actually an altar boy, you know, I just find, how can you say that looking at abuse that's going on is an evolving position? It's right or wrong. You know it or you don't know it. And to think that there are priests that did not know it, could not make that decision, and now we have one such priest who's going to be selecting the next pope, it just shows that there's a complete moral vacuum in the leadership of the church. And I'll take my response.
All right, well, I thank you for that call, and let's hear a response from you, Sally Van Strombest, since you were talking about the lack of leadership.
Well, there are several issues raised in these last dialogue, and it seems to me one place I'd like to start is, you know, the Catholic Church is known for its great intellectual tradition. And in the 20th century, just like all intellectual traditions, that had to develop as well. And one of the things that we tried to deal with is to understand our understanding of the human person. The human person is not a static being that comes to the age of reason and now is a fully human person. That doesn't, that may have worked in the 13th century. It doesn't work in the 21st century. So one of the ideas that the church received and spent time thinking about was that human beings are developing persons. The challenge that your callers have been talking about is that when it comes to social justice, when it comes to the way institutions and hunger and poverty and those kinds of things, those kinds of issues relate to the Catholic Church, we've been pretty good at paying attention to development, of looking at what the social sciences and what intellectuals tell us. We pay attention to them. But when it comes to personal issues of development, how a human person becomes a sexual being, becomes an adult as opposed to a teenager, we still look at persons in the previous theology, which is that you don't develop, that we are defined primarily by our rational mind rather than looking at the mind and saying, the mind is more than just the reasoning, logical capacity.
You're saying
it's
your faith is overly cerebral, perhaps, or something.
Well, we need to apply that notion of development to how we think about all features of the moral life, and we continue to restrict that to look at the natural law theory, which says that we are our humanity is located in our rationality rather than this whole spectrum of what St. Ignatius called the human imagination.
And again, Sally Vance Trembeth is lecturer in religious studies at Santa Clara University, and Sister Marianne Farina is associate professor of philosophy and department chair of theology at Dominican School of Philosophy and Theology at the GTU, the Graduate Theological Union. I'm looking at an email here, Sister Marianne, from a listener in Menlo Park, Jean, who writes, "What about the investigation of U.S. nuns? That's Rome asserting its dominance."
And again, I think that the way that whole investigation was finally played out, in the sense of the types of my congregation was visited by those who were investigating. And so far, we don't have any reports back from them, but the whole experience of it was a positive one. But I don't see the Pope's understanding or the particular groups that were investigating. There was a question, indeed, and I think that the sisters welcomed the opportunity, in one sense, for dialogue. Even recently, with the Leadership Conference of Women Religious, they're now involved in dialogues with the various bishops and cardinals who are involved with that area. And I think that's yes, I mean, it is something that is a concern, but I think we're, again, open to having conversations about this.
All right, and we'll have more conversations with our listeners. And John, you're next up here. Welcome.
Thank you, Michael, for taking my call. I have a question for your panel. They must be aware of the predictions of a Irish monk going back to the 12th century. Malachi, I believe, was his name, and he's supposed to have had a vision of all the men who are going to be popes on into, you know, the present time. And according to that prediction, this current pope that's going to be elected will either be the last pope or the second to the last. And then there's no other popes listed. Mm-hmm. So I would be very much interested in what your panel had to say, what their observations are on that prediction of this Irish monk who was a mystic. It was back in the 12th century, I believe.
Sister Marianne, you sound like you're familiar with this.
Just the idea of the the prophecy or the prediction. If all the prophecies that we would hold would have come true, I think the world would be shaped very differently. I don't know if I can really put a lot of confidence in these predictions. We really can't put confidence in some of these predictions with regards to the church, especially if we believe that, you know, the Holy Spirit is involved, and that there are surprises like yesterday, surprises like the opening of Vatican Council. surprises, which goes back to some of the questions earlier, of Archbishop Gomez's actions in down in L.A. No one would have expected an archbishop who was cast as very conservative, Opus Dei, would speak out in the way he did about the sexual abuse. So I think we are a church that's open to surprises. And so,
and Archbishop Gomez was the one who essentially took the action against Cardinal Mahoney. Let me thank the caller. Also, I'm wondering, George Westlake, to go back to you for a moment here. It's a strange source, but I happen to be reading Alessandra Mussolini, granddaughter of Benito Mussolini, who is in Parliament in Italy, was saying that essentially the Pope has left his flock, that to leave before you die, I guess, on the job, like our Supreme Court justices, is not in keeping with the tradition or the history. I mean, it's been 600 years after all, and on the one hand, the Pope has been getting a lot of high marks for the courage of saying, look, I'm mortal and I'm resigning and I can't go it anymore. And then there's a lot of questioning about what it means and if it's a good thing. In fact, I'm looking at another email from a listener who says, how do we know that Benedict is resigning voluntarily? How do we know he's not being urged convincingly to vacate the seat of St. Peter?
Yes, well, I think that's a minority opinion in terms of looking at the actions of Pope Benedict, and I've heard it from a couple of people who say, why not stay on? And they're thinking, of course, of John Paul, who did stay on, and, you know, his last months were not, in terms of operating as the leader of the church, were not very effective.
He was very feeble at the end, very feeble.
Very, well, yes, really disabled. And but I think there was a tremendous witness that he gave in terms of how to die well, how to bear your infirmities well, you know. And he was on this public stage, and he went through something that all were going to go through, and so that witness was wonderful. However, I think what is more important now is what Benedict is seeing, is that. You know, we need someone who can have the capacity to deal with the 1.1 billion member church and all of the problems that there are. And so I'm bowing out. So I agree that it was a very humble and bold act on his part.
Let me read some more of our listener comments. Max writes, it is high time and a great opportunity for the church to become truly Catholic by recognizing the great contribution of Catholics in Asia, Latin America, and Africa. The European church is moribund. The church's future is in Asia, Africa, and Latin America. And by the way, and contrary to what some of the pundits have to say about it, in the early centuries of the church, there were popes of North African, probably non-white origin. There may have even been a woman pope, or so it's been presumed. Here's Paul, who says, I think the Pope did us all a huge favor by resigning, and not just because the church needs a leader who is attuned to the problems and concerns of the third millennium. The fact is, had he remained as Pope until his death, it would have been considerably more difficult to be honest in one's assessment of his life. Whenever anyone dies, people feel obligated to highlight the positive. With Benedict still alive, one can be free to point out the many ways in which he failed. Richard from Campbell says, while the Pope always gets lots of press, I often wonder if he really has that much influence on world events and the lives of individual people. I hear that even within the church, the individual members often go their own way in spite of what the Pope says. This current Pope had the paper advocating social justice, some say a liberal point of view, but here in the U.S., it doesn't seem we have seen any influence on Republicans. Bottom line, should it even matter to most of us, and particularly non-Catholics, who the next Pope will be? What would you say to that, George Westlake?
Well, I think it probably won't matter to a number of people. It does get a lot of buzz in the media, of course, this conclave will. I do think, though, that for Catholics, as I said earlier, for many Catholics, especially those in the pews who are, you know, just average Catholics who work a job every day, he is a symbol, and a very important symbol, and a symbol of unity, a symbol of hope for many. And so I think for them it's very important. And I think for the world, he is kind of one of the only voices that can speak to issues like peace in the Middle East, peace around the world, to poverty and those kinds of things that that political figures cannot necessarily. Oh. So I think he has an important role.
I think we're talking, though, about what kind of influence, let alone power, the Pope actually has. Sally Vance Trembeth, can I get you to opine on that? I mean, when he makes a statement, for example, about the need for peace in the Middle East, doesn't necessarily fall on deaf ears, but it doesn't necessarily advance peace in the Middle East.
No, and that's one of the challenges, is that the minority position that your callers or the people who wrote in talked about reflects a chronic problem with the Pope that goes to the influence of the Pope, and that is they confuse the office with the service. And so when Pope Benedict's resignation, to me, is a hopeful sign, first of all, just for the current church, but also for the future, because this is the first time a Pope's resigned for a good reason, which is he's retiring. And that, what that says to me, it's a small little glimmer of hope, but it says to me that he takes seriously that we live into our 80s and 90s now. We have to think differently about that. And with regard to the specific question you asked me, it's a lot easier for a pope to be heard by the global community when their ministry is a ministry of peace and openness and love, the way that it was for somebody like John the 23rd. I mean, when John the 23rd died, people were in grief. I mean, Princess Diana's death reminded me of the grief of John the 23rd. I mean, that there was this global grieving process. And you're not going to see that with Pope Benedict, not because he's not a good man and he's not a holy man, but because of the crisis of leadership. And he and John Paul II are both stamped with that terrific crisis, appropriately so.
Well, we've come to the end of the program, and we will continue, obviously, to watch as succession moves forward and the smoke comes out of the Vatican and everything else. It is a fascinating process, and I want to thank all of you for your participation in this hour. We spoke earlier with Sylvia Pagioli, the senior European correspondent for NPR's Foreign Desk, and Sally Vance Trembeth with us in studio is lecturer in religious studies at Santa Clara University. Excuse me. Also spoke with Sister Marianne Farina, associate professor of philosophy and theology and the department chair of theology at the GTU, the Graduate Theological Union. George Weselek also joined us for this hour. We thank you, George, director of the Department of Communications and Public Policy for the Archdiocese of San Francisco. Former Vice President Al Gore will join us in the next hour, and Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, and Tina Lauerberg. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with online support from David Marks. Senior editor is Dan Zoll, and executive producer is Raul Ramirez. For all of us here at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.